All right. I'm calling this meeting of the House Special Committee on Energy to order. Today is Tuesday, March 19th, 2024. The time is 10:16 a.m. We are joined by Representative Prox, Representative Baker, Representative Schrage, and myself. I'm Representative Rauscher. I am the chair, and we do have a quorum. I would like to thank the House Records Secretary, Kale Brown, and our LIO moderator, Zach Lawhorn, and my committee aide, Craig Valdez, for all they do for this committee. Before we begin, I'd like to remind the members of the committee and the people in the gallery or the audience to silence your cell phones or any personal electronics. If anyone in the audience needs to pass a note to committee members or committee members out there, please do so through my committee aide, Craig Valdez. He'll take care of it. I would also like to have the members testifying direct questions through question and answers through the chair and vice versa. We are now joined by Representative Wright, Representative Armstrong. Today's agenda centers on bringing forward HB 368, Clean Energy Standards and Clean Energy Transfer Tax Credits. We'll commence with any thoughts from Curtis Thayer in a second. He's the Executive Director of Alaska Energy Authority. This will be followed by an opportunity for comments and follow-up questions from our committee members. Next, we'll move on to taking up and discussing the amendments that were brought forth by the closing time. Time permitting, we will open the floor for public testimony. So are there any questions before we begin? Well, Mr. Thayer, please come forward, put your name, affiliation on record. You may begin with any opening comments, or we can move immediately to questions.
Thank you. My name is Curtis Thayer, and I serve as the Executive Director of the Alaska Energy Authority. As I'm available mainly for questions, but one thing I would like to bring to the attention of the committee, as you look at a clean energy standard, or as I know there's a competing bill with an RPS, a renewable energy standard, one of the things that key with this, no matter what the technology happens to be or how this technology is achieved through an RPS or through clean energy, you need transmission lines. And that's what we're lacking in Alaska. We could have the best hydro opportunity, the best nuclear, the best biomass, the best wind, the best offshore power. We do not have the transmission lines on the rail belt to move that power to where the people are. We're doing that. There's information we talked about, the GRIP, the grid resilience, the $206 million that we've received from the federal government that requires a match, which actually gives us that redundant line off the Cook Inlet into South Central. And then looking at a future phase of that would be to connect that HVDC line going up to Healy to give a redundancy line out of Fairbanks. But if we were anywhere else in the lower 48, we would be required to have two, if not three, different transmission lines servicing our rail belt. And we have one, and we've had that one for well over 40 years. And so that is just something, as we look at this and look at the bills, I think both of them contemplate that. But I just want that to be in the forefront as you go forward and we look at what type of renewables that we want in Alaska and how best to achieve that. We still need the transmission power to move that line, that power. So with that, I'm open for questions, but I just want to keep that at the forefront.
I'll take a shot at the first question here. I appreciate you being here, by the way. Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure having you here. So you're opening about transmission lines, which this bill doesn't really talk about that much. But I would like to ask a few questions. Since there was, $206 million, I believe, that was allocated to the state of Alaska in matching funds, tell us more about the line itself. DC, AC, we've talked in the past about Cadillac versions and Volkswagen versions. We've talked about time links. We've talked about all kinds of things. I wonder if you could give us a perspective on those three things, if you would, just so everybody gets a better idea on what to expect when, and I'd just say when. I'm not going to say if. I'm going to say when that line gets built.
Okay. Thank you for that question. The GRIP funding or the grid resilience funding is for $206.5 million. It does require a match of 206 for a $413 million project. What that is a HVDC line, high voltage direct current line that we would put underneath the Cook Inlet. There's pipelines there, so it's not unheard of. There's pipelines all underneath Cook Inlet. But you would tie that in near Bernice Lake. It's up north of the Homer system and connect that through converters across the inlet. We anticipate it to be about 65 miles long, and then it will connect to Beluga across the inlet. That is actually where Chugach Electric has a gas-fired power plant, but they have lines that can take that power into Anchorage. And so that gives us that redundant loop off the Kenai. We're right now, this summer is going to be our time to look at the routing study, to look at the engineering, to look at the cost involved, and exactly how we anticipate that line to be laid across Cook Inlet. And it is about an eight-year project, looking at the timeline and supply logistics. One of the things is we kind of have a ramp up for a couple of years, and then pretty soon we have to put at least 20% down on the cost of the line to get into a production queue. There's five companies in the world that make that line currently. And that's also one of the things is there's not really off-the-shelf HVDC line you can purchase, but there are different sizes that cost varying amounts. And so that's one of our considerations in looking at that line. But that would give us that second line off the Kenai that we currently need.
So I do have a follow-up. So to build the newer line, is all the land acquired? Do we have what we need to actually commence with building it if the money was to appear tomorrow?
Through the chair, since the majority of it is going to be under the Cook Inlet, Bernice Lake is an existing substation with Homer Electric, so we're connecting there. We're connecting to an existing substation or connect with Beluga across the inlet. The key is going across the inlet. We're going to have to do, of course, environmental studies of such and look at the routing. One of the challenges that we have in Cook Inlet is there's a trench in the middle of Cook Inlet, so it might not be the straightest way across. And also with this cabling, we would also be doing a bearing at about 6 feet under into, so there's no boulders or nothing to be in the way, but it'd be a buried cable too. So those are the studies that we're trying to route and determine the best route and the most cost-effective way to do it. And that's one of the activities that we're doing this summer. That's why we're anxious to get started, because we only have, according to GRIP funding, 8 years to complete the project. And so we want to make sure that we're off to the races, so to speak, once we get the grant agreement in place so we don't miss a field season.
Is this through a casing, a liquid-filled casing? I've heard about transmission lines having to go through similar things. I don't know. Is there casing around it? And how does that – what's consist with the construction of that?
Mr. Chair, what I can do is I can provide to the committee a picture of the kind of the cabling peeled back, because it's multi-layer. It's probably, fairly good size around, 6 to 10 inches round, and there's different healing and that. So there's not necessarily a casing. The cabling is encased, mm-hmm. but you're not putting it in a different encasement across the inlet at this time. Right now we don't see that, but we have some preliminary pictures of what that is, and I can provide that to the committee with also the jet drive and how they dig in the mud and they blast the mud and how they lay the cable. We have a lot of that preliminary, but I'll be more than glad to share that with the committee when I get back to Anchorage.
Well, thank you very much. I thank the committee for letting me indulge him in this conversation, because this is not what the bill is about. Okay, this bill takes place after that cable is built. So does anybody have any questions? Representative Schrage has a question.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Chair Rauscher, and through the chair. So just on the topic of transmission quickly. So I know that one of the concerns that exists and I think is built into this bill is that the transmission isn't there to transmit the electricity throughout the state to where we need it. Where is that constraint, and does this initial phase of the GRIP application actually address that transmission constraint? And then, is it a constraint today, or would it be more of a constraint down the line as we build out renewables? Kind of when does that really become a limiting factor that needs to be addressed?
Through the chair, the constraint is today. It was actually 32 years ago when they built Bradley. Bradley is a 120-megawatt power plant. It doesn't operate at 120-megawatt for various reasons during seasonality, but the line that services it is over 50 years old and was designed to serve Homer with power, not take power from Homer go north. And that's, in essence, a 75-megawatt line. So Chugach Electric, if you were to look at it, Homer has dual lines up to what we call Sedona Sterling, and then AEA purchased those lines about 4 years ago after the fire up to Porch Creek. We're in the process of doing a $90 million upgrade on those lines right now. That was part, when you hear about a bond, that was a bond that we did 2 years ago, and that project is actually underway. That connects to Quartz Creek. And just if you were to drive down on the Kenai Peninsula and you go by Hope, there's a big substation off to you. As you kind of go up the hill, there's a big substation there. That's Chugach's, and our line ends on the bridge behind it. So it kind of give you an idea. But Chugach has been aggressively upgrading their lines on the Kenai Peninsula from Quartz Creek, which they own, into Anchorage. You can see that by the towers they put up going around Girdwood and that. If you remember, they're much different than they were years ago. And they're in the process of upgrading the line as we are probably in the same process of doing ours. The challenge that you have with that existing line is you have to take Bradley offline for a period of time where you're upgrading the lines and then bring Bradley back on. So you're mobilizing and demobilizing every 60 days or during a 60-day window generally. So that's one of our challenges. But we were doing that upgrade and is needed now. Matter of fact, the SSQ line that AEA owns was originally built in 1969. And to put it in perspective, the federal government has not put any money into transmission upgrades in Alaska since last 60 years. So we've had no, where they've helped in other states, they have not helped in Alaska in that regard. And then the HVDC line would take it off of the near the Homer system and over and across the inlet. So we have the redundancy. The fire that we had, Swan Lake fire 4 years ago, took that line out of service for 4 months. It cost the ratepayers about $12 million more in burning natural gas, which we're running out of. Kenai could not take all the power Bradley was producing, so we were spilling water and losing water over the top. And so that's where we have a congestion. And even this last winter, the existing line we had was down for 5 days due to the snowstorm between Whittier and Girdwood. It was within 5 days back in service, and a permanent repair is going to be done this summer. But again, it just shows how vulnerable we are by not having a secondary line off out of the lower peninsula into South Central Alaska and onto Fairbanks. As I've always said, Fairbanks receives 17% of the power from Bradley. So it is truly a line that continues all the way north.
Follow up for me?
Follow up, Representative.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Rauscher. So it's a constraint today. A lot of good work being done today to upgrade the line. When do we expect the transmission constraints to be addressed to where the renewable portfolio standard, as it's outlined in this bill, are able to be enforceable in theory?
Through the chair, we have the HVDC line, which again is approximately about 8 years. We'll have a better idea of that schedule. But right now we are doing those upgrades on the peninsula, on the SSQ line, in conjunction with Chugach Electric. And so we're working to figure out if we can shorten that time window down a little bit, if we can leave Bradley offline for maybe 90 days or 120 days during a construction season without it spilling water, so we don't have to mob and demobilize and we can get more work done. So that work's being done, and we're analyzing how we can shorten that time period. But either way, when you're doing transmission upgrades, we're probably looking at a 5 to 8 year outlook for both of them to be fully completed. We're trying to, like I said, the upgrading of the existing line, we're trying to speed that up a little bit. One of our issues is supply chain logistics. We have stuff on order that's literally 18 months, 2 years out that are normally, the time before COVID was much shorter.
Follow up with me.
Representative.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Rauscher. Through the chair. And high degree of confidence that we'll be able to execute on these transmission upgrades? The reason I ask is I'm just getting at how necessary is the provision kind of giving this out that if transmission improvements aren't completed, that the bill is essentially unenforceable. Does that seem necessary?
Through the chair, you know, the one thing that we're seeing in the market is a lot of IPPs, independent power producers, come into the market. And we want to make sure that power can move, and we need to have these upgrades. And, you know, AEA with the lines that we own versus the ones the utilities own, we understand that, and we're working together. That's one of the reasons why we went through that bonding 2 years ago. Was to secure $166 million to start these upgrades. And another part of that is battery storage, to have batteries in Homer and Anchorage, or South Central, because that's an MEA true gas facility, as well as all the way to Fairbanks. And so really it's a package deal. But tying, you know, I understand tying in the bill with needing these upgrades, we're going to be lost without these upgrades. The good thing, you know, what I'm pleased to say is we're progressing. We're doing the existing ones, and with this funding for the GRIP, there's $200 million that we would not have seen before. You know, that project, I have to admit, was kind of one of those that one day we can do this, and then all of a sudden we got an email at 7 o'clock one morning saying we can do this tomorrow, or we can start this project. And so I think we're comfortable and confident that we can do both simultaneously.
I have more questions, but on a different topic. Are there other committee members need?
Representative Prox has a question through the chair.
Yes, through the chair. Mr. Thayer, is the financing plan, is that plan to bond for all these projects? Or are you looking for state grants or something like that?
Through the chair, the upgrades to the SSQ line has already been bonded, and we have funding in place for that. For BESS's or the battery energy storage systems, to do in all three regions, it's about $180 million, of which we have $57 million already in hand through that bond. As far as the GRIP and the $206.5 million, of that, we need a match of 206.5. We have $20 million of that bonding, which is paid for by the ratepayer, which we're setting aside to initial work. So we need a match of 186 million. And then in the governor's budget, he has another $12.7 million. So we have about $32, $33 million of the 206 we need for the match. And we are, you know, I say we collectively, I think that between the governor's office and legislators and everybody, we're kind of looking to where that match would come from, and looking at the state as securing part of that match, if not all of that match, other than the $20 million that's already been identified that the utilities have in hand that they're providing.
Okay. Follow up?
A follow-up, Representative Prox.
Follow-up through the chair. Just history, me, why I'm asking these questions. Many, many years ago, I got involved in a commercial building and wanted to get more involved. So I went to a former senator. No, it wasn't former at the time, just a friend at the time, working for a bank. Thought I could get a loan on this and I could pay it back. Didn't matter to them. There's no risk. But they wouldn't give me the loan because they didn't think the project itself penciled out. Should have listened to them. And then I was involved with the electrification project on the pipeline, and they didn't ask enough critical people. And that ended up costing three times more than it should have, or they expected it to. And it was, the whole project was put into the project management training for Conoco in what not to do. And the point is, things can and do go wrong in a big way, and I'm not qualified to look at that. So I'm more comfortable, frankly, with paying the extra bonding this so that you have people that are buying the bonds. They are trained to look at these things dispassionately, whereas we're not. That's why I'm hoping that we can get more of the, for us to spend money on it, more of just the financials of, to go to Representative Schrage's question of, is this necessary for all kinds of other projects? I think it is, myself, but I can't prove that to anyone. And we should be able to do that. That's the due diligence part of it. The arithmetic says we need to do this, not the aspirational, I'd like to see windmills or solar panels or nuclear plants or whatever. And I would really like to see some sort of arithmetic evaluation so we could compare one thing to another and say this is why we should do something rather than individual little projects in the billions. So anyway, that was my rant, but that's why I asked those questions.
Representative Schrage.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Rauscher. And through the chair, on a different topic, we had a presentation last week on some of the possible uptake on the tax credits for the deployment of renewables through this bill. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, due to the time constraints on the committee and my own time constraints, I had to leave abruptly. I wasn't able to ask a question that I was hoping to be able to ask that I'm hoping you might be able to shed some light on. The assumptions on how much the state would be providing in clean energy tax credits would be the assumption in the presentation seemed to be that utilities would work to hit the 35% threshold and the 60% threshold, which I think is great if we're working to achieve the thresholds. My concern is actually that utilities deploy way more than is outlined through the target thresholds in the bill. And the reason I have that concern is the NREL study, I think, shows that for these co-ops, who of course are concerned about the impact on their co-op members and the cost of energy, it indicated that the lowest cost option for utilities is to go towards something like 70% renewable by 2040. Are you familiar with that study? And if that study is accurate, shouldn't we assume that, I mean, you have to take this, you know, graph that we got from them. Here's, you know, 2051, we're getting to 60%. I'm actually wondering if we're going to be hitting 70% all the way over here in 2040. And do you have any sort of projection as to how quickly utilities might actually begin deploying renewables? Because if it's quicker than is assumed in the presentation last week, I think the financial impact to the state could be much higher and much quicker than expected. And so I'm just wondering if you could provide any thoughts on that question.
Through the chair, I don't have a crystal ball into the utilities and their plans. I will say that one of the things, as I mentioned earlier, there's a lot of work now with independent power producers, whether that's a new wind farm, whether that's a new solar farm. So we're seeing kind of a shift away from the electrical utilities providing generation into IPPs. That's not going to, I don't think that's going to be the complete market shift, but we're seeing that shift, or I would say it's not even a shift. We're seeing that new in the market, in Alaska. But it goes back to in the NREL study, they make a note in that NREL study, you need additional transmission lines. They talk about what they can do today, but that's with the assumption that we have transmission to move that power different directions. But directly to your question, I don't have an idea what each individual utilities, what they're actually working on as far as moving forward. We at AEA through the Rural Energy Fund, we have funded a lot of the wind studies and solar that they're currently doing when it originally started with a renewable energy grant.
Follow up with Representative, can I, online today, we have few other people online today. We have we've got Becky Alvey, Advisory Section Manager, Regulatory Commission of Alaska. We've got Julie Esty, Chief Strategy Officer, Matanuska Electric Association. We have Brandon Spenos, Acting Tax Director, Division of Tax, Department of Revenue. So just so you all know that there are other people online that might be able to help us with some of the questions that we may have today.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Rauscher. And yeah, follow up if I may. And if Director Thayer would like to kick the question to someone else, by all means, please do.
Representative, follow up.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Rauscher. So definitely some transmission constraints as acknowledged in the NREL study. I think we heard from you just a little bit ago that pretty high degree of confidence. You seem bullish that we would get through the transmission upgrades in less than the next decade. So let's say that everyone agrees with you that transmission upgrades are going to be taken care of in 10 years. So under that assumption, we should be building out renewables to provide the lowest cost energy to our ratepayers, to our co-op members. There's an amendment that I get the general sense is probably pretty broadly supported to include independent power producers as being eligible for these tax credits. So if the transmission constraints are taken care of and we have an NREL study that says the lowest cost option is to get to around 70% renewable by 2040, I guess, do you agree with the NREL study conclusion that the lowest cost pathway forward is probably to go towards somewhere near 70% renewables by 2040? Are we even roughly accurate with that study? Let's say it's 2050. Do we generally agree with the consensus that the lowest cost option is going to be to build out those renewables?
Well, through the chair, you know, I've read the NREL study. I think there's points in it personally that I agree with, and there's some points that I disagree with, and there's some that I think the jury's still out on. Because one of the things, and when the study was given and presented, a lot of the cost of doing renewables in Alaska are an unknown cost. And how they operate, too, is an unknown. How they operate in really cold weather, that's, to a certain degree, that's an unknown. But again, the NREL study is at least is a step forward to look at what the options are for us on the rail belt or in Alaska in general. I don't know if 70% is the right mix. The one thing that we definitely need is firm power. When it's 30 below out, we want the lights to work. And if there's a high pressure in that, when it's cold and there's a high pressure, the wind turbines do not work in that particular region where that is. That doesn't mean that if we had connecting grid, we had our grid was connected and we had dual, that maybe Fairbanks is a greater wind regime than Anchorage and we can move power that way and vice versa. We also look at the Dixon diversion at Bradley, where we can divert and increase Bradley by 50%. That would displace 1.5 billion cubic feet of natural gas, 7.5% of the unmet need in 2030. But again, with that, we need transmission upgrades. And that has to be, that's a renewable, it's part of that mix. And so I think really, and that's what we're looking here, and the NREL helps us with that. What is a good mix for us? Because again, we need that firm power, but we also want to make sure that we have all the power options available to us.
Thank you.
Any questions? All right. So, seeing no more questions, I'm going to move on to the amendment part of what we're here for. So, Representative Shragi, you can move the First Amendment if you'd like.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Rauscher. I move amendment number one. Brief at ease.
Yep. All right, we're back on record. Representative Shragi, did you want to discuss your amendment?
Yeah, and just for clarity, in case members have amendments that aren't numbered, this is going to be Work Order 33-LS1170/H.1. So this amendment would shift the target dates for renewables. It would shift them from 35% by 2036 to 30% by 2030, so moving that deadline up 6 years, and moving 60% by 2051 to 55%, so slight decrease on the percentage threshold, but moving that target date from 2051 to 2035. I did this for a couple of reasons. One, I think there's a pretty broad acknowledgement from the energy community that the state is going to start rapidly moving towards renewables, especially given the natural gas shortages in South Central. And so I think we're already making significant progress towards renewables, but given the fact that we will potentially be providing significant tax credit incentives to these utilities, I think that we should be more ambitious. I think we heard during some of the testimony in committee that given the level of crisis with energy security issues on the rail belt, we need rapid action and decisive action towards renewables, and I think moving these dates up does so. I'd also note that as I currently read the bill, there are no penalties for not meeting these thresholds. And in fact, I'm not really sure that we should be calling this a renewable portfolio standard, but maybe renewable portfolio target or aspiration or goal. And if we're going to be aspirational and just put unenforceable goals in a renewable portfolio bill, I think that we should really truly be aspirational and move those dates up to ones that acknowledge the level of immediacy around this issue. So that's the reason I offer this amendment for consideration and would invite discussion on it. Thank you, Chair Rauscher.
So, Representative, would you mind if I ask to consult Julie Estee from the MEA? Ms. Estee, are you online right now? Can you hear us? And if you can, could you, did you hear the question, or did you hear the amendment? The question is, what do you think of the amendment Representative Shragi is trying to put forth? And if so, please put your name on record and give us your opinion.
Thank you, Chairman Rouse. Can you hear me well?
Julie, Ms. Sessi, you're cutting out somewhat a lot. So we heard your first
can
word.
Can you hear me better now?
I can hear you now. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Chairman Rauscher. For the record, this is Julie Essie. I'm the Chief Strategy Officer for Matanuska Electric Association. And yes, I did hear the amendment. This would be to adjust the goals to a 30% by 2030, I believe, and then a 60% by 2035. Did I get those goals correct?
55%. Representative Shragi, would you like to repeat the amendment?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Rauscher. You had that largely correct. It's 55% by 2035, not 60.
Great. Yes, thank you for the amendment, Representative Shragi. As MEA, our goal is energy diversification at this point as we're looking beyond our gas contract ending. And, you know, there's a lot of things in the hopper, as you guys have been discussing. We have, we're in conversations with developers on wind and solar. Transmission is absolutely one of the constraints on some of those larger projects. And then others are, you know, as far as variable power, how do we integrate that into our system with regulation? As Curtis Thayer indicated, you know, part of it is having firm power, power we can count on no matter what and when. And so as I look at those goals, you know, I think that the 30 by 2030 is something that is within, you know, as an aspirational goal within grasp. I do, when I think of the 55% by 2035, I currently don't see a path to that in that time frame. And so while I do agree that it'd be great to be aspirational, I also think setting realistic goals would ensure that that they're motivating to the utilities, to our members, and to independent power producers. So those are just some brief comments. Happy to stay on and answer more.
Thank you, Ms. Estee. Representative Armstrong, you have a question?
Thank you, Ms. Estee. Through the chair, you had mentioned that there's not a path to 2035. Is 2051 kind of the earliest? Is that the realistic goal, or is there another year, 2040, 2045, that might be more amenable?
Thank you, Representative Armstrong, through the chair. As we look ahead, there are still so many unknowns. One of those is transmission. How much power can we move? How large can these be? We're also currently doing some studies among the utilities in partnership with each other on what is possible right now. We have consultants working on what would it take to regulate, how much variable power can we fit on our existing system? When do we need those upgrades? And unfortunately, we just don't have those answers in hand. So I wish I had a certain answer for you right now, but there's still a lot of unknowns. And again, I think if the goal of this is for the legislature to set aspirations and to motivate both utilities and the market to come up, I think making those realistic so that even the developers can say, ooh, you know, I don't know that I can do that quickly, but if there was a little bit longer horizon, then I can mobilize to be there for that development. So again, I think there's just so many unknowns right now for me to pull one out, pull out a number is tricky, but I would say the 2035 is there. Like I said, I just don't even see a realistic path to that.
Mr. Thayer. Would you like to come forward for a minute? I have a question I'd like to ask you. Mr. Thayer, since this bill, the majority of this bill, takes place after the transmission line is built, I was wondering, can you give us a timeline? I know you gave us a timeline before in other committees and possibly this one, but I thought we would reiterate it. Give us a timeline on when you envision the line to be fully completed and operational.
Mr. Chair, when you look at the upgrading of the existing line that we have, that is currently ongoing in phases. We're starting our phase now, so that's at least a six-year project. And the HVDC line, which is also off the Kenai Peninsula, that is currently 8 years, but we'll hopefully have a more refined schedule on that this summer. But say 6 to 8 years as we look at doing these upgrades.
Thank you, Mr. Sayers. So my math, being 2024, 6 to 8 years is 3032. And if I understand your numbers right, 30% by 2030 is before the line is even completed. So I'm going to have to just oppose that math as a reality for what I can see as a possibility at this point. That's my opinion. Is there any other comments that anybody would like to make? Representative Prox.
Thank you. Through the chair to Representative Shragi, you mentioned a crisis. I guess, are you referring to the impending shortage of Cook Inlet gas? Okay. No, this doesn't make sense. There's other options to address that particular shortage, and that's not contemplated in this bill, probably something that we're going to have to do between now and 2030 to address the situation in Cook Inlet. So I don't like the word. I don't think we should be thinking about this in terms of a crisis. That's not the right way to approach this. And I think we're better off allowing more time to figure this out in an orderly manner. So I would be opposed to this amendment as well.
Are there any other comments? So do you maintain your objection, Representative Wright?
I maintain my objection.
Just a quick wrap-up, if I may.
Sure. Representative Prodi, shrugging.
Yeah, thank you. And just to clear up any confusion through the chair, or maybe to the chair, I think we did just hear from Julie Yetzi that 30%, excuse me, by 2030 is in fact achievable, even with the current transmission that we have. So I think at least with that first target, it's absolutely achievable. And Again, these are unenforceable targets. So they're simply aspirational goals to say, hey, let's try to do better. Let's try to deploy more renewables to offset natural gas usage and ensure that ratepayers and the rates that they're paying are protected. Certainly understand the concern around the second target, given that transmission likely wouldn't be built out and completed until the early 2030s, and then the 55% target being in 2035 probably is, again, fairly aspirational. I'd, of course, be open to a friendly amendment to push that date out a little bit, but again, we should set policy in this committee and be aspirational, signal to utilities that we expect them to protect ratepayers and expect them to build out renewables, not only to address the energy issues in South Central and throughout the state, but also to keep costs low, and would hopefully look to members to support this amendment to, again, set that high standard or target for our utilities as we work to make sure that this issue is addressed in a serious way. Thank you.
Any other comments? Representative Armstrong.
Thank you to the chair. I'd like to offer a conceptual amendment.
Representative Armstrong, your conceptual amendment.
I move that 2035 on page 3, line 10, on line 7. Well, let's think how to do this. All right, line 7 on the amendment, change 2035 to 2045.
Okay. Representative Shragi.
I have no objection.
Oh, I object. I just need to be objectionable. That's it.
Okay.
I object.
Is there any more discussion on this, the date, in the conceptual amendment? Okay. So if there is an objection, we're going to take a roll. Are you ready to take a roll?
Sure thing.
All right, please do.
Representative Baker?
Rafferty's. Back on record. Thank you very much. So we are doing a conceptual amendment to amendment number 1, just for reiteration's sake, on record. Would you, Kale, would you please begin the roll call?
All right. Representative Baker?
No.
Representative Schrodt?
Yes.
Representative Wright?
No.
Representative Prox?
No.
Representative Armstrong?
Yes.
Representative Rauscher?
No.
4 nays, 2 yays.
Okay, with 4 yays and 2 nays. Did you say 4 yays, 2 nays?
Sorry, I said that backwards. 4 nays, 2 yays.
With 4 nays, 2 yays, the conceptual amendment fails, which brings us back to the original amendment number 1. There is a maintained objection.
I do maintain my objection.
So begin the so this is on amendment number 1. If you would begin the roll call.
Representative Baker.
No.
Representative Shragi.
Yes.
Representative Wright.
No.
Representative Prox.
No.
Representative Armstrong.
Yes.
Representative Rauscher.
No.
4 nays, 2 yays.
Okay. With 4 nays, 2 yays, we have a failed amendment. So I'm going to move amendment number 2 down the line, as Representative McKay is not here at this moment, which brings us back to amendment number 3, which is by Representative Shragi.
I move amendment number 3, which is, if you're looking at the work order, it's amendment H.3.
Objection.
For sake of discussion, Representative Shragi.
Yeah, thank you. So this amendment strikes the opt-out provisions of the Clean Energy Standard in Section 5, Subsection H. As I previously mentioned, this bill doesn't actually put any requirements on the utilities to meet the target dates discussed previously, and so this is unnecessary for that reason, but also unnecessary because there are other opt-out provisions in the bill. So this is really just a cleanup, and I think recognizes a lot of what Amendment Number 2 would have spoken to, which is that, again, there are no requirements placed on the utilities, and so the opt-out provisions are unnecessary.
For the record, I support the amendment, for the record. So, Representative Armstrong, you had a comment? Representative, anybody have another comment? Representative Wright, do you, or was that Representative Prox?
I'd just like to take a minute to read this.
Sure.
Yeah.
Brief at ease.
Well,
okay, thank you.
Representative Wright, do you maintain your objection?
I do not maintain my objection.
Are there any more objections to Amendment Number 3? All right, Amendment Number 3 passes. Representative Shragi, Amendment Number 4?
I move Amendment Number 4, which, if you're looking at the work order number, is Amendment H.5.
Objection for purpose of discussion.
Representative Shragi, go ahead.
Thank you, and to the chair. So Amendment Number 4 would allow for independent power producers to take advantage of the clean energy tax credit. As currently structured, the bill would only provide the tax credit to utilities that build out renewable energy. This would allow for independent power producers, which are playing an increased role in producing energy in Alaska, to also take advantage of that clean energy credit. In my view, if you're producing or building clean energy power plants, you should be eligible for the credit regardless of what type of entity you are.
Any comments from the committee? I find myself, I find the amendment friendly. Representative Wright, do you maintain your objection?
I remove my objection.
All right, any other objections on Amendment Number 4? Amendment Number 4 passes. Representative Shragi, Amendment Number 5.
I will not be offering Amendment Number 5, okay. Which is, Work Order H.6.
Representative Shragi, Amendment Number 6.
Thank you. I move Amendment Number 6, which is Work Order H.16.
Objection.
For the purpose of discussion, there's an objection. Representative Shragi.
This amendment, brief it is just really quick.
Brief it is. On record, Representative Shragi, you are about to explain your amendment.
Yeah, thank you. Amendment Number 6, and again, that's Work Order H.16, would provide some enforceability around the standards outlined in the bill. So this would require, I think it reads pretty self-explanatory, but essentially in order to take advantage of the clean energy standard tax credit, you would have to be in compliance with the clean energy standard. I think this is certainly adds a level of accountability to the bill as opposed to just being a tax credit for any newer renewables. It provides some accountability to that tax credit in saying that you have to actually be working to meet the standards outlined in the bill. We heard in discussion on Amendment Number 1 that certainly the 35% by 2036 is achievable, certainly for Matanuska Electric Association at the very least. I think that utilities should be required to make sure that they stay on track if they're going to take advantage of that tax credit, and that's what this amendment does. Happy to answer any questions that there might be on this. Thank you.
Okay. Anybody else have a comment? Representative Prox.
Well, thank you, Chair Rauscher. It would seem to me if they are applying for the tax credit, you would think they must be trying. So I don't know that this would really add any value, and there's no reason for a penalty to make this more complicated than it is. So I'm not in favor of this amendment.
Any other comments from the committee? Just as a comment that I'm probably going to pose it for some of the same reasons at this time. So Anybody else have any comment that they'd like to make? Okay. Do you maintain, who had the objection, Representative Wright?
Maintain my objection.
You maintain your objection? All right. This will call a roll.
Representative Shaggy?
Yes.
Representative Wright?
No.
Representative Brox?
No.
Representative Armstrong?
Yes.
Representative McKay?
No.
Representative Baker?
No.
Representative Rauscher?
No.
Five nays, two yeas.
With a count of five nays, two yeas, the amendment does not pass. Amendment number 7, Representative Rauscher, will not be offered. That is H.9. Good. All right. Amendment number 8, Representative Rauscher, will like to move amendment number 8.
Object for the purpose of discussion.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much, Representative McKay. It increases the tax credits from 0.2 cents, which in the presentation, and as noted by Representative Prox, seems too low to make any meaningful change. This increase brings it to 2 cents per kilowatt or $20 per megawatt. This helps offset the real costs of building new generation that will alleviate the huge spike in energy costs that we'll soon see with natural gas imports. So that's the purpose of the amendment. Is there any discussion on it? Representative Shraggy.
Thank you, Chair Rauscher. So we had a presentation last week that I think outlined this scenario. Is it your understanding, in conforming with the material presented to us last week, that over the next approximately 20 years, that the cost of this amendment would be upwards of $500 million, $655 million cumulatively?
Yes. Thank you.
That is quite the – through the chair, if I may, to the chair. That is – quite the price tag, $655 million to, and I mean no disrespect to you or to any of the utilities, but for them to do what I think we've heard from them they're already planning to do. This seems to me to make this a very expensive state-subsidized tax credit for the deployment of renewables with not a lot of protections or accountability around the bill. So I'm weighing my position on this amendment because I certainly would like to see more renewables deployed, but at a cost of $655 million to the state when I think the governor's 10-year fiscal plan outlook shows a $10 billion deficit in the next decade. I'm grappling with how on earth do we pay for this? I mean, is there a fiscal plan that's in the works or something else? $500 million, that's just an incredible amount of money, and I have no idea how the state bears that burden.
Well, I believe 2 cents or 0.2 cents just isn't going to move the needle at all. I just feel that way. So we're trying to make this a little bit more enticing, and we don't really write a check, as a matter of fact, but it is credit.
I think you've got a question over there.
Representative Prox.
Thank you, Chair Rauscher. I'll admit that we don't write a check, but effectively, we do write a check. Forget the semantics. A tax credit is effectively a dedicated tax, if you think about we're not able to spend other revenue. So we should think of it in those terms, and to that regard, I agree with Representative Shraggy that this is an expensive subsidy. Not a good idea. Thank you.
Representative Prox, since you came up with this similar idea before, I was wondering, do you have a different number in mind?
No, I agree that this would provide more incentive, whereas the 0.2 cent wouldn't provide much of an incentive, but I disagree with the concept of subsidizing energy, because it's just not a good way to distribute resources. Then, that makes energy more expensive, but that's the real cost. It's closer to the real cost of the alternatives for the public. So,
Representative, does anybody else have a comment? Representative Wright, Representative McKay.
I objected for discussion. Your
objection?
No, I'll remove my objection.
I will object.
Okay. Representative Prox, is there any other comment? There's another objection. Mr. Brown, would you please call the roll?
Representative Wright?
Yes.
Representative Prox?
No.
Representative Armstrong?
No.
Representative McKay?
No.
Representative Baker?
Yes.
Representative Schrage?
No.
Chair Rauscher?
Yes.
4 nays and 3 yeas.
All right, with 4 nays, 3 yeas.
Four nays, three yeas.
The amendment fails. So we move on to amendment number 9, Representative Rauscher. I move amendment number 9, which is point 11.
Objection for purposes of discussion.
Yeah, this amendment creates clarity and sets in statute that expansion projects, which are typically cheaper than building all new, would qualify their newly portions for credits. So that's basically what it does. It's a simple one. And is there any objection?
Object.
For purpose of discussion?
And I just object. And just for the record, I think I had already objected for purposes of discussion, but happy to have another objection join me.
So there's no objection to his objection?
Yes, I'll speak to that.
Okay, go ahead.
To clarify my objection, the grocery stores in Fairbanks give you points for gasoline if you buy lettuce. And it's a little bit hard to figure out, but that just increases the price of lettuce in the same way that frequent flyer miles are paid for through ticket prices. And it's an incentive, and it's a good business idea to for the grocery store to conceal the price of their gasoline and give you all those incentives. But it's not a good idea for us to fall for that ruse. Thank you. Personal opinion.
Any other comments? Representative Schrager, you have a comment for your objection?
No, I'm actually going to, I don't want to cut debate off, but I didn't see any other hands, so I'll remove my objection.
Representative Prox, I assume that puts you up for an objection here.
I just like being objectionable. That's right.
Okay. Any more comments from the committee? Representative Brown, Mr. Brown, will you please call the roll? Sorry for the promotion there. It was
Representative Prox?
No.
Representative Armstrong?
Yes.
Representative McKay?
Yes.
Representative Baker?
Yes.
Representative Schrage?
Yes.
Representative Wright?
Yes.
Chair Rauscher?
Yes.
6 yeas, 1 nay.
With a total of 6 yeas, 1 nay, the amendment passes. Amendment number 10. Representative Wright.
I move amendment 10.
Object.
For purpose discussion. Representative Wright.
Amendment 10 would add schools to as a qualified producer of, and receivers of credits. It also allows schools to build and generate their own energy, potentially reducing the costs. So, It's pretty much Amendment 10.
Any comments from the committee? Representative Shragi.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Rauscher, and to the chair. You know, I think I'm supportive of this amendment, but, you know, I'm curious if we've heard from the school districts whether this is something that they're asking for. You know, my general sense is that right now school districts are having a hard time just keeping teachers in the classroom and, you know, leaky roofs repaired. I'm not sure whether they're going to come up with the capital to deploy clean energy for the purposes of taking advantage of this tax credit. So, I mean, do the school districts actually have the capacity to take advantage of this? I mean, I just, given the financial situation that our school districts are in and the fact that we just failed to provide a BSA increase through our sustenance of the veto yesterday, do school districts actually have the working capital to take advantage of this?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Baker, you have a question. You have a comment.
I'd like to respond to Representative Shragi, if I may, sure. through the chair. So coming from a rural perspective, Representative Shragi, in, say, my district, the schools would most likely be able to work with the tribes in our communities that do have a lot of funding coming for renewable projects. I know this is something that's been discussed over the years, being that the schools no longer are able to take part in the PCE benefits. So this is one way that a local community would be able to put back into their school through an entity that has the funding coming in. The school could provide some kind of match, some kind of training program, whatever it might be, that would help incentivize folks to learn how to get into the IPP industry. I appreciate Representative Wright for putting this amendment forward because it, for rural Alaska, I think this would be a good move considering what's coming down the pipe.
Thank you, Representative Baker. Representative Shragi, how many years did you have to go to find $650 million? How many years was that out?
I believe it was in your
drawing there.
2051, Chair Rauscher? 2051.
So basically, you're speaking of long term, and today you're on this amendment. You're speaking of what happened on the floor yesterday. So I'm trying to understand how you're not envisioning something to change in the future, but to stagnate as it was on the floor yesterday. I'm just trying to understand that.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Rauscher. And to the chair, I think there are both short-term and long-term ramifications of any policy that we set, and I think we have a duty to look at both those horizons. You know, long-term, I look at the financial borderline insolvency of the state and the fact that we have no fiscal plan to address the billion-dollar deficits that are projected over the next decade, and in theory beyond that, in fact, worsening beyond that. And in the short term, I wonder, you know, as we consider amendments, what the actual capacity is for entities within the state to take advantage of this, whether it's a utility coming up with the working capital to finance a new renewable project, or it's a school district looking to, again, finance a project to take advantage of this tax credit. I think you have to look at things through both lenses and just trying to take that well-rounded approach to vetting legislation. Thank you, Chair Rauscher.
Appreciate it, as always, Representative Shragi. Thank you. Representative Prox, you have a question or a comment?
For the maker of the amendment, through the chair, to the maker of the amendment, this is a new and interesting twist on the debate. Perhaps this is to Representative Baker, I guess. It would seem that some other entity could get the tax credit, which then they could effectively sell the power to the school. I'm not sure that this is necessary, and it complicates the equation in my mind. Could you explain why they couldn't do that without this particular credit from the schools?
Through the chair.
Representative Baker.
To Representative Prox, explain why somebody else taking part in the credit. I don't follow the wording of your question.
If I understand how this is supposed to work, the tax credit part of this, I'm sorry, through the chair, It would seem your example, you used the tribes. They could set up a clean power generating system for the schools. But they could set up a clean power generating system for anybody and be eligible for the tax credit anyway. So I'm not sure that this accomplishes the intent or makes it easier, but it does complicate the political question.
Representative Baker, your comment?
Through the chair, thank you for the clarification. As the amendment is written, a school district may apply, mm-hmm. and tribes may use their funds to become an IPP and sell energy. It's not a rule that they would have to. My thought process from my example is potentially using the funds to go forward in some kind of joint partnership, some kind of joint venture, where using what's available in the community from different pots of money to help the school, which is in rural Alaska, it's the heart and soul of the communities where sort of people gather. It's where things happen, whether it's a funeral, a potluck, a sports event. So the example I use is a potential, not a every school, every tribe must do this following a blanket set of rules, if that makes sense.
Representative Prox, I'm going to let you speak one more time, and then...
Chair, it does. Thank you.
All right. Are there any other comments? Representative Armstrong has a comment.
Thank you, through the chair. Just a clarifying question, and sorry if I'm misunderstanding this, but work order H5, I don't have the amendment, which included independent power producers. Wouldn't that cover tribes and schools and anyone else who ended up undertaking something like this? Or do we need this specific call out for school districts? I'm trying to imagine in my head quickly how this is going to work if a tribe or a native corporation does something and it's on the I don't know. This is just seeming a little complex. I'm not quite sure how it works out. And wanting to make sure that it's necessary and not already covered by something else.
Representative Armstrong, for the record, I'm going to ask my staff member, Craig Valdez, to come up. Take the microphone. Please put your name, yourself on the record and with your name and your affiliation, and then if you would, can you answer the question?
Yes, my name is Craig Valdez. I'm staff to Representative Rauscher. So make sure I understand the question correctly. Do we need this amendment if we're already including IBPs? And while working with the offices, as they brought these amendments forward, the question was the IPP probably will cover, but there are circumstances why, again, in the future, 25 or so years from now, that might not be the same case. The school district might have funds through the federal government, through other entities where they have the ability to do these projects. I know under the federal government right now, schools are able to apply for different grant programs, not under IPPs, but as their own, as a separate school district. So that would cover them in these situations where an IPP would not cover them. So it adds another available path. And while IPPs probably would cover most of those paths, but not every single one of them.
Representative Armstrong, are we good here?
Yeah.
All right. Representative Shragi.
Yeah, thank you. On mostly the same topic through the chair. Wouldn't it be better for these sorts of projects to be deployed by an IPP where they have the technical expertise and the ability to carry out these projects? I mean, I'm thinking about this amendment and the prospect of a school district deploying renewable energy projects or clean energy projects. I mean, in some ways, I see this as incentivizing a growth in administration because you need people to manage these sorts of projects and you need to hire new maintenance people to be able to work on these complicated electrical systems and monitoring systems. And I'm just, you know, we want to keep schools focused as much on education and the classroom, and I'm concerned that this creates an incentive for school districts to start doing other things when we could just have an independent power producer doing the work, putting a facility on site, maybe coming up with some sort of agreement with the school district to provide power where that IPP has all that expertise, has the economies of scale, and can do that at a better in a better structure that prevents us from having to load school districts up with more complexity in what they do and the facilities that they manage. So I don't know if the maker of the amendment has any thoughts on whether or not this is better to be carried out by an IPP, but I guess in some ways I see this as an incentive to take school districts' attention away from the classroom and towards other functions of a school district.
Mr. Valdez.
Yeah, if I can make a quick comment, I want to point out that they don't have to. This would be a choice the school district could make and may make and may not choose to not make. Again, with working with offices with the amendments, from my understanding, this is an option to give them more flexibility. Again, for rural communities that you operate, slightly different than Anchorage and some of the larger ones where it might make sense for them. It might not. In that case, they don't need to do it. But when we mention incentives for action, it would have to play out better for them. There are many instances where an IPP could be the consultant company working with them. It's still on school properties through the school. But again, that is in May. It's not they have to. They don't have to take advantage of this. But if it works out for community, they have the option or ability.
Maybe just an additional comment. I appreciate that it's an option, not a mandate. I don't know that I want to give school districts another option that incentivizes them to pursue something other than the classroom. I think school districts right now are doing way too much with way too little funding, and as much as possible, their efforts should be focused on the classroom. And I worry that this gets them distracted with other options that are out there.
Representative Wright.
So, as stated through the chair, as stated before, it is an option. And, you know, we can't have a classroom without having any kind of power, electricity to heat these rural schools. So this is just creating a foundation for folks to have an option to, if someone like another organization wants to donate, that is there. Right? They have the option, and it's we just want the schools open. Because we all care about education, especially in rural Alaska. One of the places that is hit hardest when it comes to the cost of energy. So that's what the Amendment 10 is all about.
Sorry. Representative Baker.
Thank you, through the chair. And to follow up on that, there are already, for example, in my home school district, Northwest Arc Borough School District, there's an entire department that is solely focused on the maintenance and operation of the school facilities. A large part of that is researching how much fuel is going to cost, doing bulk orders that is going to cover 10 different schools for a whole year, covering for contingencies and making plans. So having this as an option in their tool belt would make it so that they don't have to rely on the high price of diesel, which is what all of the schools in my district back home in Northwest Arctic do rely on. So that's why I'm supporting this, is because it creates an option for that person who's already just working on planning and making sure that the school is running, has heat, has power, rather than creating a new division of the school district hierarchy.
Chair Rauscher, can I ask a follow-up to Representative Baker on that?
Representative Shragi, we are trying to get done today, but go ahead if you have something important to add.
Yeah, well, I mean, Anchorage School District also has a very complex and built-out maintenance department. But maybe it's different in your region than in mine. But even in the Anchorage School District, the largest school district in the state with the maintenance department they don't have the technical expertise around building out renewable projects, right? I mean, does your school district have the capacity to build and manage and run a clean energy project on site? Because that's where I think – it's not that I don't think schools should be taking advantage of this. I absolutely think that if it saves money, they should do that. But why is an IPP not the better route to go in providing clean energy on site? Why not go into a partnership where an IPP is using some school grounds and putting some solar panels up to produce that power? It seems to me it's a better fit through entities that already have all that technical expertise, as opposed to, again, giving an option. Again, it's an option to a school district to go out and hire people that have this technical expertise. That seems to me like it starts to become a distraction. Again, I get that it's an option, but it just doesn't, I'm not sure that it fits. Trying to wrap my head around it.
Well, Representative, not all businesses fill out a Schedule C because it's very complicated and they just soon take the loss. It's an option and it gives them a chance to save money. I'm going to support this myself because I could see an option is always better than no option later on for those that want to. And so just for myself, I'm going to support it. Representative Baker, did you have one more comment before we you're going to maintain your objection, I assume?
I think so.
Okay, good.
Final follow-up through the chair. Using my home school district, it is the Northwest Arctic Borough School District. They do work in hand-in-hand with the Northwest Arctic Borough, which does have an economic development. It's got an energy department. Maybe not an energy department per se, but they do have folks who their sole job is to work on projects such as getting heat pumps installed in homes in the community, getting tribes and the local governments, the cities where applicable, to find more economic ways to keep lights on, keep things warm. And again, as Mr. Valdez mentioned, they're in these smaller communities because of the hand-in-handedness of the borough, the tribe, the city with the school. And being a small community, the load would be able to be shared through someone who has somebody on staff and already is working with the school on current projects, whatever they may be. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, if there are no more comments. Mr. Brown, will you please call the roll?
Representative Armstrong?
Yes.
Representative McKay?
Yes.
Representative Baker?
Yes.
Representative Shragi?
No.
Representative Wright?
Yes.
Representative Prox?
Yes.
Chair Rauscher?
Yes.
Six yeas and one nay.
Okay, so with a count of six yeas, one nay, amendment number 10 passes. We're moving on to amendment number 11. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move amendment 11, which is work order H.13.
Object for the purpose of the discussion.
Representative Baker.
Through the chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This simply adds 1 cent per kilowatt hour bonus to communities already receiving PCE funds, using PCE as a determining factor for who is receiving versus who is not. As we just debated very heartily, the rural regions of Alaska face some of the highest energy costs in the state and, frankly, in the country. This rural bonus would help move the needle in the adoption of cheaper, sustainable energy sources that could displace exceptionally expensive diesel and provide cash infusions for those who are looking to invest in small rural microgrids.
Any comments from the committee? Representative, you maintain your objection?
I will drop my objection, Mr. Chairman.
Any other objections to this amendment? Amendment number 11 passes without objection. Moving on to amendment number 12, Representative Rauscher, I do not offer this amendment. Amendment number 13, Representative Rauscher. This amendment removes, I move amendment number 13H.15.
Object for discussion.
Okay, there's two objections for a point of discussion. This amendment removes the clause that utilities would not receive the credits if they are under a waiver, such as a clause causes market uncertainty and also punishes them for things outside of their control, such as natural disasters and acts of war. So, any other comments or points of discussion on this amendment? Is the objection maintained?
I withdraw my objection.
I heard two.
I withdraw mine also. Sorry.
All righty. So, are there any objections? Okay, without objection, amendment number 13 passes, which brings us back to amendment number 2 by Representative McKay, which was overlooked because his presence was not here at the time. Representative McKay, amendment number 2.
Mr. Chairman, I withdraw amendment number 2.
All right. Representative, the number 2 is withdrawn. That was 8.8 for those that want to know which amendment that actually was, if they don't have the order written down. So, all right, so we are, have now gone through all the amendments, and at this time we still have time today, so I would like to move to public testimony. At this time, I'm going to open public testimony for HB. I got so many bills in my head, I got to keep them straight. 368. Is there anybody in the room that wants to testify for HB 368 at this time? All right. Is anybody online? I do see Ken Huckaba at this time. If Ken, if you can hear me, this is your chance to spend 2 minutes telling us your opinion on HB 368. Begin your name on record. Give us your affiliation and begin your testimony.
Yes, sir. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Okay. Ken Huckaba, Wasilla, H-U-C-K-E-B-A, represent myself. 2 minutes is kind of hard considering all the import and all the amendments you folks just went through. But I guess we'll get out a little bit. You know, the origination of this entire thing was a little over 14 years ago and was written not by legislators, but by REAP. And it was even stated so that it wasn't written by legislation. So that was germinated from the UN mandates and guidelines for this renewable portfolio standard. And now here we see it today before us, and this is what you're voting on. This isn't something that people wanted, citizens wanted or needed. We know that it was penned and authored by a left-wing environmentalist organization they call NGOs now. And so that in its problem, and then we saw the origination for the transmission line. We saw the original letters based on it, that it wasn't for redundancy. It wasn't for efficiency. It was for to enable renewable portfolio standard. So that's what this is all about. And anybody saying anything else, they're just adding things on to help they'll get it passed. So they say renewables. They're saying they're more affordable. And then we're here today that IPPs are going to get credits. Well, if they're cheaper, they shouldn't need credits. IPPs are for profit. We don't have for profit entities generating electricity in our system right now. And as I stand as somewhat a member of a co-op that we partially own our co-op, they shouldn't be allowed to come into the mix. We shouldn't have for profit in a mix of our already expensive and bloating power costs. Renewables are clean, now you're calling clean energy, as diverted to it, they're neither reliable or affordable. And as we've seen everywhere else they've put these things in, costs have escalated and they've had more outages. And so, and you look at all these costs that we're saying right now for all the upgrades required to enable them, they should pay these costs, not taxpayers now. We shouldn't be bonding for anything unless it is just for reliability as we exist now. If we're going to enable IPPs to come in here, they need upgrades. They should pay for them. How are they cheaper if we're bonding and paying for all these upgrades to enable IPPs? Independent power producers, again, are grifters for tax credits and to make profit off of us, taxpayers. It doesn't make sense. So I just hear this schizophrenic discussion about all these hundreds of millions of dollars to enable IPPs to come in and charge us more for our electricity. It doesn't make sense. So I don't see how we should accept the narrative of state control and expansion or our power production either. I think our co-ops are doing quite a good job with the RCA oversight. I don't know how this big takeover and doing the whole IPP thing doesn't work. I know we're running out of time here, and I appreciate it, but the whole carbon control narrative is nothing but implementing Marxism, and we're playing in those waters, and everyone should know that. We're doing all of this in the name of carbon control. It has nothing to do with cheaper power. In Alaska, we should have affordability and reliability, and we have coal, oil, and gas to do these things. We should not be adopting a globalist expansion of their ideas of carbon control. Thank you, folks. I appreciate you.
Appreciate your comments, Mr. Huckaba. Thank you very much. We also have online Casey Andrews. Can you hear me, Casey?
Hi, can you hear me?
I can hear you. Please put your name on record and give us your affiliation and begin your testimony. You have 2 minutes.
Okay, for the record, Kathy Andrews. I'm representing myself out of Anchorage. I'm opposed to the concept of this legislation. I would be okay with it if it were completely voluntary. However, then it wouldn't need to be a law, then would it? The very idea of the state having to mandate this specifically regarding our energy makeup means that there is an inherent risk or problem that the end user is not willing to pay for. It has been stated there is no requirement. That is a lie, as only certain sources of power are allowed per this legislation. The end user is not willing to pay for unreliable and unaffordable sources of energy. Mandates to achieve a certain percentage of intermittent sources of energy will do just that. This is seen across the lower 48 and in Europe. Germany is a stark example of what we should be avoiding. The trifecta to the demise of our grid is this bill, the Electric Reliability Organization, and the mandate to allow for-profit independent power producers on our grid. These central planning mechanisms that remove the utility boards from having a say in representing the ratepayers will erode the reliability and affordability of our energy, resulting in our utility co-ops becoming nothing more than a beat-down and unreliable billing function. There is proof of this. In August of 2023, the North American Reliability Corporation, NERC, identified energy policy and grid transformation as the two top risks among 5 significant evolving and interdependent risks to grid reliability. The federal dollars are tempting, and appeasing the governor for his investors is tempting, but I see this state as no more capable of the others when it comes to adopting common sense energy policy. Let the best players play, resist subsidies, mandates, and other forms of energy favoritism by letting technologies advance or fail in markets based on their own true merit or lack thereof. Thank you for hearing me today.
Well, thank you very much, Ms. Andrews. Thank you. And appreciate your comments. So we're going to move on to Ken Griffin. Ken, can you hear me? And if you can, please put your name on record, give us your affiliation. Begin your testimony. You will have 2 minutes.
Yeah, Ken Griffin, G-R-I-F-F-I-N. The only affiliation I have is I'm one of the true stakeholders to Alaska because I'm a taxpayer here. I invest and live here, volunteer here, donate money here. But what I can tell you is, without question, I don't get the ideas behind these things. The truth is there's no economics. Somebody just said a minute ago that this is going to help communities that have expensive power. It's not. You cannot help a community by giving them money or subsidies. You have to help them stand on their own 2 feet and afford things. And this isn't going to make energy any cheaper or more affordable. Maybe it will for a short amount of time, but really it's just an offset somewhere else. If you want to make energy 10 cents a kilowatt hour, you're not going to do that with subsidies because it's still 20 cents in the kilowatt hour. Because it's just an offset somewhere else, whether it's inflationary practices like this or not. So I get the feeling that since we only get 2 minutes, this is more of a complaining session than anything else, because I get the feeling a lot of the stuff is already made, the minds have already been made up. These bills are all crafted around nothing but credits and subsidies. And any economics professor anywhere, any Wall Street investor, anybody putting money anywhere knows you can't survive on tax credits or things like that. What happens when they die? What happens when they change? What happens if Trump comes in and slashes 45Q? We know what will happen. Everybody will say, oh, my God, now the state has to pay this. Your people will die. These ideologies are crafted around pulling people's heartstrings. They're not crafted around good, clean economics. You can't run a country on tax credit. And I know that, and everyone in that room knows that. You guys all just said your version of knowing that a few minutes ago. So why any of you think you're representing your people by passing a bill like this, I have no idea. And you know it. You should be embarrassed by it. And I don't know how you can stand and look at your constituents and go back and tell them what you're doing is good. It's horrible. It's horrible. That's all I got to say. Be a superhero. Thank you.
Thank you, Ken. We appreciate your comment. We're going to move on to Todd Lindley. Todd, if you can hear me, can you give us your name, give us your affiliation, and begin your testimony? You have 2 minutes.
Good afternoon. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Todd Lindley. I'm calling from Anchorage on behalf of myself. I do not support this legislation. It establishes construction timelines. It potentially violates the privacy of the ratepayers by collecting personal data. And it's reliant solely on tax credits in order to do what the bill is claiming to do, which is to provide cost-effective energy that's not detrimental to the ratepayer. I think those, when you look at those two statements of cost-effective and not detrimental in the context of clean energy, those are oxymorons. I think you should listen to the testimony that's been provided here today by those on the line, as well as what has been submitted. Remove this bill from the ledger. It has no purpose and will only drive our electricity costs higher and higher into perpetuity. Thank you for your time and letting me provide my testimony today.
Thank you, Mr. Lindley. Thank you very much for your comment. I do not see any other testifiers online at this time, so I'm going to close public testimony. And is there any more discussion on this bill? The intent of the committee is to actually move it out of committee today. It's gone through public testimony. It has gone through the amendment process, which were due at a certain time. They were all brought in. They were all vetted here in the committee. So before there's a motion to move it out of committee, is there any other comments anybody would like to offer?
Chair Rauscher.
Representative Schrage.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Rauscher, and to the chair and to the committee. You know, first off, I appreciate the process that we've had for this bill. I think we've had a good bit of discussion and a fair process on the amendments, and I appreciate the time and attention that you've given the committee to work on this important issue. I support working towards incentivizing renewables and deploying more renewables in the state of Alaska, but I do still have some concerns with this bill, and I'm not exactly sure who it supports or who's asking for it. I mean, we just heard unanimous public testimony against the bill. I know the utilities have spoken favorably to the bill, but haven't taken a formal position on it. You know, typically we have many of the renewable organizations supporting bills such as these, and I'm just not hearing support for the version that we have before us. And I wonder if it's because we've got something wrong or we need to spend more time on it. But you know, lacking a specific answer, I can just speak to my own concerns with the bill, which is that there's no accountability to it. There's just a tax credit, a government-subsidized tax credit, which over the next 20 years could have a significant impact on the state's finances without any accountability to actually meet the standards. In fact, as proposed in the bill currently, whether a utility is already planning a renewable project or not, whether it makes economic sense or not, whether it's part of their plan or not, they just get a tax credit for doing it. And it doesn't actually incentivize any different behavior. And that's where I like having some sort of accountability around the standards that are in the bill. You know, we don't necessarily have to have a stick that says you'll be punished if you don't hit the standards, but I think at least something that says you don't get the carrot if you don't hit the standards would be useful. I worry that what we're doing is subsidizing status quo action in many cases, and that it doesn't do enough to really move the ball on this issue. So I think I suspect the will of the committee will be to move this bill along. For myself, I'm going to mark amend because I think there's more work that needs to be done on this. I think we need to do more work to get public support behind this bill, or at least stakeholder support behind this bill. I don't think we're there today. Would prefer some more time to work on these issues and talk with stakeholder groups. But as of today, I think I'm going to be an amend because I just don't think we're there yet. So, that, again, I really appreciate the process that we've had, Chair Rauscher, and I mean no disrespect with that stance. I'm just trying to get the right policy for Alaskans, and I think we need to do a little more work to do that.
Any other comments? Representative Prox.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kind of ambivalent. I don't agree with this bill. On the other hand, I don't think we're going to change much if we hold it in this committee. Kind of hate to put the burden on the finance committee. When this gets out to the public, we're going to continue to hear strong opposition to it. So I don't know, as far as moving it out, I guess at this point I would be against moving it out, but I'm also against spending any more time on it.
Representative McKay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I withdrew my amendment earlier because it would have made almost everything in the bill optional. And in principle, I agree with the testimony that we just heard. So I just don't think we're ready for prime time. I'll be a no vote on moving it out of committee. But I do want to express my respect for the governor and the chairman here that I recognize that you really would like to move it out. But I'm just going to have to be a no vote because I don't like subsidies. We're having a lot of discussion on the oil and gas side about whether to have tax breaks for various projects in the oil and gas industry, particularly Cook Inlet. And there's a lot of good arguments against that. So here we are again talking about tax breaks and who actually pays for them. So I just thought I'd let you know that, Mr. Chairman. Greatest respect for your position and what you're trying to accomplish. So just want to let you know that. Thank you very much.
Any other comments? Do I hear an objection?
I think we did.
Yep.
You want to add the sure, I can be the objection. I object.
Okay. Do you want a motion?
Well, I guess we better have an motion first.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if we were doing an informal motion or not. So, yeah, if we want to put a formal motion on the table, that'd be great.
All righty. So, Representative McKay.
Okay, this is Representative McKay for the
record. Better judgment. Go ahead and make your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So this is Representative McKay for the record. Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill number 368, Work Order 33-LS1170. /H as amended from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes, and further to authorize legislative legal services to make any needed technical and conforming changes to the bill.
Object.
Okay. Any more discussion? Mr. Brown, will you please call roll?
Representative Baker?
Yes.
Representative Shragi?
No.
Representative Wright?
Yes.
Representative Prox?
No.
Representative Armstrong?
Yes.
Representative McKay?
No.
Chair Rauscher?
Yes.
Four yeas and three nays.
So the total of four yeas and three nays, the bill passes out of committee. Will please stay until we sign the book there. Thank you very much. And then we will, with no other business before us, I will adjourn the meeting at 11:57 today.